All right, our next speaker is Joseph Black.
This will turn yellow when the two minutes left together.
Thank you. This study was conducted in order to understand the horizontal transmission of Helicobacter bermudra nucleopolyhedrosis virus, which is abbreviated here MPV, in soybean fields in Arkansas that were infested with corn earworm. Corn earworm is in the Lepidopterus family Noctuidae. It migrates as far north as Canada during the growing season using wind currents. It overwinters as a pupae in soil that in areas that do not see four consecutive days of 0 degrees Fahrenheit. This includes the southern half of Arkansas. It's a polyphagous feeder, feeds on many hosts and many row crops, including cotton, corn, sorghum, and soybeans. In soybeans, it causes defoliation and fruit damage. This results in indirect and direct yield losses. In Arkansas, in soybeans, the current threshold is a dynamic threshold that changes based off your growth stage, your bean market value, and the cost of control. When you're in your vegetative stage, the threshold is a defoliation percentage of 40%. Once you reach reproductive stage, you use this table or a similar table with drop cloth to determine your threshold based off the current crop value and the control cost that you want to use. So if your crop is worth more money, you're going to be quicker to pull that trigger than if your crop is not worth as much. Also, if you're going to be using a more expensive insecticide, you're going to be a little slower to pull that trigger than if you're going to use a cheaper insecticide. Growers can do a couple things culturally to reduce their risk for these bollworm flights by planting early and by using early maturing varieties. This misses those later, larger bollworm flights. Also, heart stack traps are used to monitor that progression of migration. But once the corn earworm reaches the field, we rely on our biological control to suppress those populations below that economic threshold, predators and parasitoids both. However, once that threshold reaches your economic threshold, or once that population reaches your economic threshold, an insecticidal application should be applied using a recommended insecticide for your state. Pyrethroids, diamides, and others are some of the ones that are recommended for Arkansas. However, resistance is an issue with this pest, and as shown in one of the previous talks, the pyrethroids are losing efficacy, and they are becoming resistant to those. Also, recently Belt was taken from the market. This leaves us with relatively few classes of insecticides that we can use, which brings up HERMPV. HERMPV is a biopesticide, and it's in the viral family Baculoviridae, which are known for their occlusion bodies. They're protein crystalline structures that surround the nucleocapsid. The nucleocapsid is simply enveloped DNA. It's the virus DNA. These occlusion bodies protect that DNA from environmental conditions that degrade that DNA. The biopesticide used is occlusion body is suspended in organic solution that's sprayed like other insecticides. And once it's sprayed and applied to the leaf, the larvae then ingest that. The occlusion body travels to the midgut where the alkaline conditions in the midgut break down that protein structure, releasing that viral DNA, which then goes on to infect the midgut epithelial cells. Once in those cells, it reproduces a simplified version called budded virus, which is simply that nucleocapsid with the viral DNA inside. It does not have the occlusion body. This is then disseminated across the larvae to all cells, and the symptomology of this in early stages, the larvae stop feeding. In later stages, the larvae will migrate to the top of the canopy, they become lethargic, and there could be a shrinking or an accordion-like shape to that larvae. In these later stages, the virus reverts back to creating those occlusion body structures using host cell proteins in the nucleus. This then lyses those cells, breaking them open, and liquefying that larvae, re-entering the environment with that virus, allowing for horizontal transmission and the continuation of this cycle. So that horizontal transmission has several modes of being vectored. Abiotic conditions are one. Wind and rain act as a mode of vector. They transport that occlusion body that's found in soil, which acts as a refuge for this, and transports that occlusion body to the crop canopy where it can be ingested and infection can occur. Infected larvae can infect other larvae through several modes of action. Cannibalism of an infected larvae by a healthy larvae will cause that healthy larvae to be infected. Also, the frass that infected larvae defecates has viral DNA present in it and is capable of infecting a healthy larvae. Surface contamination through vomiting or simply liquefaction of that larvae, and also when that larvae is sprayed initially and moves around the plant before it becomes lethargic, can spread that virus as well. Predators or parasitoids play a role in this as well. A parasitoid that emerges from an infected larvae is also infected, and every larvae that oviposits in will become infected. Also, parasitoids that oviposit into an infected larvae contaminate their ovipositor, and every larvae that they oviposit into after that will become contaminated as well. Predators also play a role. When a predator feeds on an infected larvae, its frass contains viral DNA in concentrations high enough to cause infection for up to 10 days after it feeds. So the objective of this study was to try and take all these different modes of action, all these different transmission vectors, and quantify that horizontal transmission across this soybean field. We wanted to know how fast it's spreading and how far it's getting. The methods that we used, we took a 50 by 50 foot area and made an application on the edge of the field. We sampled at distances from 0 to 25, 25 to 50, 50 to 100, and 100 to 200 feet away from that application area. We took three samples at each distance, and we did that 3, 7, 14, and 21 days after that application was made. We used a new sweep net for each distance, and samples were taken from the outside, the farthest distance away, towards that application area. Samples were then frozen for a minimum of 48 hours to ensure that the arthropods present were dead or non-moving. And this illustration shows the progression and the sequence and the approximate location that each sample was taken at. As you can see, the sampler moves across the field, staying in that one zone, that one distance. He leaves the field, he exchanges sweep nets, he puts the samples into a cooler, and then he enters the adjacent distance as he works his way across. He makes sure when he leaves the field not to leave the field in such a way to reduce the potential for anthropogenic movement. Once the samples were frozen for 48 hours, we inventoried each sample. We counted the arthropods present and we identified them. We then put them into a 15 milliliter test tube and they were emulsified. Once they were emulsified, we used this centrifuge here to extract the occlusion bodies through a series of washes and cycles. And then that occlusion body was then sent through a DNA extraction kit using the smaller centrifuge to extract that viral DNA that was present. That DNA was replicated using PCR and analyzed with an electrophoresis gel. Now, electrophoresis gel, you load this gel matrix, you put it in a solution, and you send current through it, and this separates those DNA strands based on size. And a good analogy for this is when you think about a barren soil and you have wind blowing across that. The wind's not going to be able to take those gravelly particles or those bigger clumps of dirt very far, but it can take those clay particles really long distances. And so the idea is it separates it by size using that force. That gel is then viewed under that UV light, and we sequence positive samples by sending them to an off-site lab. So this is what you would see when you looked under that ultraviolet light. The first thing you want to notice is your ladder. This is a reference of size. So you should know the approximate size of your sample that you're looking for, and this gives you a reference for that. The next is a known positive. This was added. It's a sample that was added before PCR in order to make sure that PCR actually worked. If that bar was not present, we know that PCR failed and we did not get a successful replication of our DNA. These are positive samples. Wherever a bar is present, it's a positive sample. wherever bar is not present, it's a negative sample. However, you'll notice that there's some potential interference. We have some slight, very faint bars right here. It might be hard to see right here, but they're there, trust me. These are either interference or positives, like I said. So these also were sent to that sequencing lab in order to be sequenced to make sure that they were either positive or negative. That previous gel is very hard to understand unless you know where everything was loaded and the order things were and all those parts that I talked about. So we simplified it by making this map. The black area is where the virus is present. The white area is where no virus is present. This is the same information that was presented in that gel. At 3 days after the application, we know that there was virus in the application area. By 7 days after the application, the virus had spread as far as 100 feet in all three of those 100-foot samples. It's important to note here that up until this point, and for this sample date, the population in the field was 1 to 2 larvae per sweep. After this point, the population crashed to 0 to 2 larvae per 10 sweeps. So for 14 days after the application, we only had one sample outside of our application area that was positive. And at 21 days, there was no virus present in the crop canopy. So the potential impacts of this exposes those potential alternative methods. By knowing how far this virus is traveling, we understand better the distance it can spread, which means the grower might not have to spray the whole field. He might be able to do a grid application or a strip application, relying on this horizontal transmission to cover the rest of his field and saving him some money. It also, by understanding how long this is active in the crop canopy, it reveals the potential for that cross-generational infection. So, say you get a flight of bollworm into your field and you spray it. 7 days later, you get another flight into your field. Is that virus present in enough concentration to cause that infection into that concurrent generation? Those are the questions we're hoping to answer with this study. It's important to note here as well, this study is one field for one growing season, and in an upcoming growing season, it's going to be replicated several times. With that, I'd like to acknowledge my advisor, Gus Lorenz, Travis Foskey for the use of his lab, Nick Sider, Nikki Talon, Aaron Cato, Sarah Cato, Michael Cheney, Andrew Plummer, and the rest of the summer crew. I'd also like to thank AgBiTech for their support, and the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture Research and Extension for funding. With that, I will take any questions.
We have time for questions or two.
Yes, sir.
So your sampling area wasn't the working center regions around your treatment area. You set that up with respect to prevailing wind direction, or you had sort of 180-degree marks on this is where you spray.
Could you repeat that question?
It appeared to be from your diagram that both areas where you treat the community, and you examine the different zones around that, but it wasn't a 360 degree sampling area, is that correct?
Right, because it was located on the edge of the field.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. I did 3 pre-samples of the canopy within the field, and I did 3 soil samples. I have not processed my soil samples, but there was no MVV in the crop canopy at the time of the application.
Any other questions? We still have 1 more minute. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.